On October 4, 1987, five dangerous terrorists belonging to the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, PIJ, escaped from the IDF's Gaza prison. 2 days later, the Shin Bet, with the help of local agents it was running in Gaza, located the terrorists in a hideout apartment in the Sejayiya neighborhood. A team from the agency's Birds unit, disguised as Arabs, kept the apartment under observation. Nearby, special forces of the Yamam, the police counter-terror unit, prepared to act, under the command of David Sur. The Shin Bet guys saw them getting into two Peugeot 404 cars, one white, the other light blue, heavily armed and driving off. We tailed them, and the moment they spotted us, they opened fire. Next to the soccer field, we caught up. Four of the terrorists were killed by the first volley fired by the Yamam. A fifth man, who escaped from the vehicles, was shot later. A Birds operative, Victor Arzuan, was also killed in the exchange of fire. The funerals for the five Palestinians turned into a stormy demonstration. Protesters shouted in the streets that the five had been murdered. The rioting was more violent than anything the IDF had witnessed in the occupied territories thus far. From an operational point of view, said Sur, who was later to become a deputy commissioner in the Israeli police and chief of the Tel Aviv region, the location and liquidation of the five terrorists was a clear-cut success for the Yamam. But Sur also admitted that this tactical accomplishment, and others like it over the years, had blinded Israeli intelligence from seeing the big picture, and made them miss the dramatic development that was about to take place. Even the violent funerals were not perceived as being more than localized outbursts of anger. Then, on December 8, the driver of an IDF tank carrier lost control and crashed into a line of cars carrying Palestinians on their way back into the Gaza Strip from work in Israel. Four were killed and seven injured. The fallacious rumor soon spread that the accident was actually an intentional Israeli act of revenge for the fatal stabbing of an Israeli 2 days before. The funerals of the dead workers once again became mass protests. A wave of demonstrations swept across the West Bank and Gaza in December 1987, marking the start of the Palestinian uprising against Israeli rule, the Intifada. The Shin Bet, the IDF, and the government were stunned, and for weeks failed to grasp the significance of the protests, so much so that it did not even occur to Defense Minister Rabin when they began that he should curtail a trip abroad and come back to Israel, says the PM's military secretary, General Nevo. The IDF had believed for years that it could control the Palestinians with minimal forces, but when rioting mobs hurled rocks at small detachments of soldiers, who had no crowd dispersal equipment or protective gear, the soldiers responded with gunfire. More than 1,000 Palestinians were killed. Many more were wounded, and Israel's international standing took a nosedive. Each evening, the world saw on TV how the Israeli troops aggressively suppressed masses of Palestinians demanding political independence and an end to occupation. The underdog equation had reversed completely. Israel was now Goliath, and the Palestinian Arabs, in the eyes of the international community, were now David, with his slingshot and stones. The Intifada, said then Mossad director Nahum Admoni, caused us a lot more political harm, damage to our image, than everything that the PLO had succeeded in doing throughout its existence. Lacking an adequate response to the uprising and without a real understanding of its causes, Israel once again turned to the weapon it was so familiar with, and which many believed could change the course of history. Targeted killings. Abu Jihad, who'd already survived repeated Israeli attempts on his life, was once again the primary target. Partly that was because of his own boasting. In an interview on Radio Monte Carlo in January 1988, he claimed to have given the order to start the Intifada. The PLO reiterated this in some of its publications. The Arab world applauded. Israel's political leadership accepted his declarations as the absolute truth. The heads of the intelligence community acknowledged, or at least did not contradict, their authenticity. But Abu Jihad was lying. Neither he nor Arafat had given any order for the commencement of the Intifada. It had surprised them just as it surprised Israeli intelligence. In truth, it was a popular uprising, and it was young men in their late teens and early 20s, acting independently from the leaders in Tunis, who ignited the flame. But the facts of the matter did not interest the heads of the PLO, the Arabic media, or Israeli intelligence. Moreover, that over-eagerly accepted truth, however misconceived, was an attractive one for the Israelis. If the uprising was caused by discontent built up among the Palestinian population in the occupied territories over long years of arbitrary military rule and Israeli encroachment on their land, its root causes would have to be addressed. If it was all a PLO plot, it could be brought to an end simply by killing the man behind it. After the Intifada broke out, Defense Minister Rabin ordered the IDF to give the Mossad all the assistance it required to plan Abu Jihad's assassination. Amman Chief Lipkin Shahak was still not convinced that such a large and complex operation was necessary, but he grasped that the political circumstances had changed, and he withdrew his objections, at least during the planning and training stages. Meanwhile, Abu Jihad and Arafat tried to ride the wave of international sympathy that the uprisings generated. While covert preparations for the raid on Abu Jihad's home in Tunis were underway, he and Arafat initiated their own clandestine operation, a clever public relations exercise. They called it the Ship of Return operation. The idea was to sail a vessel into Haifa, carrying 135 Palestinian deportees from Israeli-controlled areas, and also as many journalists and camera crews as would accept the invitation to cover the voyage and its dramatic ending. The PLO leaders wanted the voyage of the Ship of Return to look like that of the Exodus, the well-known steamer that illegally carried Jewish immigrants to British Mandatory Palestine back in 1947. Fatah tried to keep the plans a secret until the last minute, but failed, and the Mossad received real-time notification. The Palestinians had chartered a ship in Piraeus, but the ship's owners canceled after Israel warned them that if they let the project go ahead, their ships would never be allowed to berth in Israel again. Instead, the PLO purchased a Japanese-built ferry ship named the Sol Frin in Cyprus for $600,000. An urgent meeting of the Israeli cabinet was called to discuss the subject, and they approved a joint IDF-Mossad clandestine operation to block the Sol Frin, even before it could sail from Limassol port. The hope was that thwarting the plan and killing its participants would produce a sense of despair in the Palestinian leadership, a reduction in the media coverage in the occupied territories, and deal a blow to the motivation for continuing the Intifada, said one of the ministers who took part in the meeting. On the morning of February 15, 1988, three of the PLO activists who had been sent by Abu Jihad to Cyprus to organize the voyage of the Ship of Return got into their car, not far from the hotel where they were staying. Rover, chief of bayonet, and Eli were sitting in another car, watching them, after many tense hours of surveillance, during which the local police almost caught the Israelis. When the three Palestinians got into their vehicle and started it, Eli pushed a button, detonating another of his bombs. The three Palestinians were killed. 18 hours later, naval commandos dived under the Sol Frin and attached a small limpet mine to its hull. It blew a hole in the side of the vessel, which began to sink. The voyage of the Ship of Return, the Palestinian Exodus, was over before it could begin. "Listen, history plays strange games," said Yoav Galant, commander of the naval commandos, as he climbed dripping from the Black Sea at 3 a.m. onto the Israeli missile boat waiting for him. He was referring to the voyage by his own mother, Fruma, in the original Exodus many years before. On March 14, The Israeli security cabinet under Prime Minister Shamir met again to discuss the killing of Abu Jihad. The prior approval of his elimination by various prime ministers over the years, including Levi Eshkol, Golda Meir, and Yitzhak Rabin, was not valid under a different premier. And even if the same man was heading the government, the security forces would still have to seek renewed approval if much time had gone by, because it was possible that the political circumstances had changed or the prime minister had changed his mind. Approval had to be given immediately before a targeted killing was carried out, the moment that operational readiness was reached, even if it had been green-lighted some time before. On the face of things, Shamir could have made do with his own order to do away with Abu Jihad, says Nevo. However, Shamir was aware that Abu Jihad was no ordinary target, and the reactions to hitting him could be out of the ordinary. He decided not to take sole responsibility, and instead to bring the matter to the security cabinet for its approval. The Likud and Labor each had five ministers on the panel. Shimon Peres, head of the Labor Party and then serving as foreign minister, declared that he was firmly opposed to the assassination. "My information was that Abu Jihad was a moderate," he said. "I thought it would be unwise to kill him." The four other Labor members, including Rabin, who had already approved killing Abu Jihad earlier, expressed apprehension about the international condemnation that would be leveled at Israel, as well as the danger to Israeli soldiers and Mossad operatives, and they joined Peres in opposing the operation. Shamir and the four Likud representatives voted for it. A tie meant there would be no operation. Finance Minister Moshe Nissim of Likud decided to try persuasion. He asked Rabin to join him outside the meeting room. "Look at what the Intifada is doing to us," he said. "The public's mood is very despondent. The IDF has in the past executed actions with great resourcefulness and creative thinking, but it hasn't happened for a long time. We have to renew the sense in the world, in the international community, but first and foremost among the citizens of Israel, that the IDF is the same IDF that has done marvelous things over the years. We have to carry out this mission for the sake of the national morale. Politics, the withering of the national morale, demanded a blood sacrifice. Killing Abu Jihad, at least the way Moshe Nissim saw it, was an act more symbolic than practical." Rabin was persuaded. He returned to the cabinet room with Nissim and announced that he was changing his vote. By a vote of 6-4, Operation Introductory Lesson was given the green light. Nissim, who was the son of a chief rabbi of Israel, would never regret that he'd persuaded Rabin. "In the whole world," he said, "there isn't another army that is as meticulous as the IDF about values and norms of conduct and assuring that innocent people aren't hurt. But there is a Talmudic precept. If a man comes to kill you, rise early and kill him first." Abu Jihad's home in Tunisia, Israeli intelligence operatives believed, was the perfect place to kill him. It was located on one of the prettiest corners of a well-tended and exclusive development of private homes and broad, clean streets, just a few thousand yards from the beach, which gave a team of assassins relatively easy access. Tunisian police patrols would need to be avoided or distracted, but otherwise Abu Jihad was protected by only two men. It was a relatively isolated location, only lightly guarded, said Nahum Lev, the deputy commander of Sayeret Matkal. Furthermore, Abu Jihad returned there each night when he was in the country. It was a superb place to lay an ambush. Abu Jihad simply never believed that someone would reach him there. The Mossad had operated in Beirut or Syria or Europe, but never in Tunisia, so Abu Jihad felt relatively safe. Killing Abu Jihad in his home, Israeli intelligence believed, would also be suitably menacing, suggesting to the Palestinians that no one is safe anywhere, even in his own bedroom. The plan to assassinate Abu Jihad in Tunisia had been developed by Caesarea over the previous year. Three Caesarea operatives disguised as Arab businessmen had scouted routes from the beach and mapped the neighborhood in detail. The Mossad and Amman's units 504 and 8200 tracked Abu Jihad's movements, charted his travels, noted his habit of buying tickets on multiple flights to make it difficult to know when he would be traveling and where. His home and office phone lines were monitored. Oded Raz, then an officer in the section of Amman's research division that dealt with terror, said that, "In following Abu Jihad, I came to know and respect the man we were facing off against. True, he was a terrorist, but also a model family man and an authentic leader who had the good of his nation in mind." Still, the Israeli political and intelligence leadership wanted to kill him. The good of the Palestinian nation, to their minds, was a direct threat to the good of their own country. As they saw it, Abu Jihad was, and about this there can be no argument, the man behind the deaths of hundreds of Jews. Defense Minister Rabin, the punctilious military man, was concerned about many details of the getaway route and the safety of the troops. No less important, he wanted to know what would happen if, once we get to Tunis with this whole armada, and we break into the house, and then our patient isn't in at all. The Mossad people explained their plan to make sure that Abu Jihad would be home before the signal was given to commence the raid. Rabin was satisfied, and with the occupied territories in chaos and Abu Jihad, rightly or wrongly, claiming credit, Operation Introductory Lesson finally was authorized. IDF Deputy Chief of Staff Ehud Barak was the overall commander of the operation, and a short time before it was scheduled to begin, he led a planning meeting at General Staff Headquarters in Tel Aviv. Amman officers showed him their scale model of Abu Jihad's neighborhood. Barak abruptly pointed to the house across the street from Abu Jihad's. "Who lives there?" Barak asked. "Abu al-Hol," one of the Amman officers replied, "the PLO's internal security chief." "And who lives here?" Barak asked, pointing at a house nearby but not next door to Abu Jihad's house. "Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen," a Mossad operative answered, using the real name and nom de guerre of another top PLO official. "It's pretty close," Barak mused. "Why shouldn't we visit him as well? What with this entire huge armada going to Tunisia, it's two birds with one stone." "Ehud," a senior Mossad official interjected, "drop it. It will only complicate an operation that is really complicated as it is." A short discussion, an argument, really, followed. Barak insisted on using the opportunity to take out two targets. Such a strike, he maintained, would send PLO morale plunging, and could have a desirable effect on the wave of unrest in the territories. The representatives of the Mossad and Amman were categorically opposed. "We can't guarantee that both targets will be home at the same time," they argued. "You are the commander, but we recommend sticking with Abu Jihad alone. It's quite enough if we give him what he deserves." In the end, Barak gave in. Thus, the life of Mahmoud Abbas, the man who would succeed Arafat as head of the Palestinian Authority, and whom Barak, among others, in time would come to regard as a bold partner in peace efforts, was saved. "It's difficult to judge such matters in retrospect," Barak said. "In real time, from the operational point of view, it was very enticing. On the other hand, it was clear that a strike at that level against their leaders would actually have legitimated attacks on our leaders by them." Six Caesarea operatives arrived in Tunis on April 14, on four different flights from Europe. Three of them, two men and a woman, traveling on bogus Lebanese passports and speaking perfect French, paid cash to rent two Volkswagen transporters and a Peugeot 305 sedan, all of them white and each from a separate company. Those vehicles would be used to drive the Seret Matkal men from the beach to Abu Jihad's home and then back again. The other three operatives were shadows. They found a clump of trees from which they could monitor the house and make sure Abu Jihad was inside. The drivers would evacuate by sea with the kill team, while the shadows would leave Tunis on commercial airlines once the operation was over. Meanwhile, five Israeli missile boats were steaming toward Tunisia, carrying the raiding party, a mobile hospital, and powerful communications equipment. A larger vessel, fitted out as a helicopter carrier, but disguised to look like a regular cargo ship, had a reserve Sayeret unit ready to be flown in should something go wrong. The convoy halted 25 miles from the Tunisian coast, well beyond the country's territorial waters, on April 15. Below, in the water, the Israeli submarine Gal provided a quiet, invisible escort. Far above, an Air Force Boeing 707 served as a communications relay station, while also monitoring Tunisian frequencies for any trouble. It was capable of jamming Tunisian radar and air control if needed. Israeli F-15s were patrolling just off the coast as well, ready to intervene if necessary. The sun was sinking into the waters to the west when rubber dinghies went over the sides of the missile boats. Each held two naval commandos and six Sayeret Matkal soldiers. They motored quietly toward shore, dusk turning to dark on a moonless night. A third of a mile from the beach, seven Flotilla 13 commandos dived off the dinghies and swam underwater toward the beach. The first to set foot on Tunisian soil was the commander of Flotilla 13's raiding force, Yoav Galant. The beach was deserted. The commandos set up a broad semicircular perimeter to secure it, while establishing radio contact with the boats and with the Mossad operatives waiting in their cars. The commandos told the Mossad operatives to approach the waterline, then told the 26 men in the dinghies that it was safe to come ashore. The Sayeret men hustled to the waiting Kasereya vehicles, where they changed into dry clothes that they'd brought in waterproof duffel bags. They were going to slip into Abu Jihad's neighborhood posing as civilians, some male and some female, then break into his house and kill him. Still, they all carried POW cards to prove that they were soldiers in case they were captured. The naval commandos spread out to keep the beach secure until the Sayeret squad returned. The three Kisaraya operatives who'd been monitoring the house watched through powerful binoculars as Abu Jihad's car pulled up just after midnight. Two bodyguards, one of whom was also the driver, went inside with him. The driver stayed only briefly, then went back to the car and dozed. The others sat in the living room for a few moments, then went down to the basement and fell asleep. In another bedroom, Abu Jihad's baby boy, Nidal, slept in his crib. His wife, Intisar, and his 16-year-old daughter, Hanan, were waiting for him in the bedroom. Intisar recalled their conversation. "I was very tired. I asked him if he was tired, and he said no. I asked him to come in to sleep, and he said that he had a lot of work to complete. He sat at the table in our bedroom and wrote a letter to the Intifada leadership. Hanan was with us in the room. He asked her what she had done during the day. She said that she had gone horseback riding. Then she remembered that she wanted to tell him about a dream she'd had the previous night. She dreamed that she was in Jerusalem with a few friends. They prayed at a mosque, and then suddenly Israeli soldiers expelled them and chased after them. She ran and ran until she went outside the city walls, and then she saw her father. She asked him where he was going, and Abu Jihad said that he was going to Jerusalem. She asked him how he could get into Jerusalem because it was full of Israeli soldiers. He said that he would ride a white horse. After she finished telling him the dream, Abu Jihad took off his glasses and said, "Oh, Hanan, yes, yes, I am on my way to Jerusalem." The phone in the villa rang. Abu Jihad picked it up. Israeli agents tapping into the line listened as the aide who handled his travel arrangements told him that he had a seat on a flight to Baghdad leaving Tunis a little after 3 a.m. This was a problem for the Israelis. They planned to enter Abu Jihad's house at about 1:30 a.m. to be as sure as possible that everyone would be asleep. But if they waited until then, it was likely that their target would already be on his way to the airport. They couldn't wait that long. The operation had to happen immediately. Yiftach Reicher, head of the Special Operations Executive, who was also at the Seaborne Command Post, called Sayeret Commander Moshe Yaalon on the radio. They spoke in code and in English, in case the conversation was picked up. "Reicher, Bogart, this is Richard. You can leave the station. You can leave the station. Do it fast. I say again, do it fast." Then Reicher realized that, Because Abu Jihad was getting ready for a flight, both he and his staff would likely be awake. "Bogart," he said, "this is Richard. Because the boss is leaving, I want to tell you there are people who are not sleeping at the office." "Ya Alon." "Okay, Richard, I understand." Riker called one of the Kesareya operatives watching the house from the trees. "Willie, is there anything new near the office, including the red car?" "Willie." "Negative." "Riker, Bogart is on his way. Before entering the office, he will call you. If there is any change in the situation, let him know, because he needs the okay. You're okay." The two transporters hauled 26 Seret Matkal men, armed with micro Uzi and Ruger 22 pistols fitted with silencers and laser pointers, into the neighborhood. Two Kesareya operatives, a man and a woman, drove the Peugeot a quarter mile ahead to scout the road and make sure that the main force would not run into anything unexpected. All three vehicles stopped about 500 yards from the house. The commandos began creeping forward. But final, positive identification still had to be made. Lookouts had seen Abu Jihad's car arrive and watched him and his bodyguards go into the house. But according to the protocol Rabin had signed, that was not sufficient. Three fluent Arabic speakers from Unit 8200, who'd been co-opted to the Mossad for the mission, had put in hundreds of hours studying Abu Jihad's voice and quirks of speech. Wearing earphones, they sat in the command bunker in Tel Aviv while technicians set up a phone call to the al-Wazir residence via an exchange in Italy, the way he generally communicated with the occupied territories. The technicians played crowd noises in the background. "Ya, Abu Jihad!" one of the voice experts shouted into the receiver. "They've arrested Abu Rahma! And now the sons of bishops want to take the whole family to prison." He added an Arabic curse. "Insha'ila yishirbu waridat al-nisa." May they drink menstrual blood. Abu Jihad tried to calm the speaker down so he could get more details. In the meantime, the technicians in Tel Aviv kept the conversation going until all three experts raised their hands to indicate that they had identified the voice for certain. "Introductory lesson, you have a green light," the command bunker in Tel Aviv radioed to the forward command post at sea. That message was immediately relayed to the force on the ground. Nahum Lev and another soldier dressed as a woman went first. Lev was holding a large box, apparently of candies, but inside was a pistol with a silencer. He walked up to the guard sitting in a car next to the house, showed him a hotel brochure, and asked him how to get there. The sentry studied the brochure. Lev pulled the trigger and shot the man in the head. Lev signaled the rest of the squad. A small detail moved forward with a hydraulic jack to force open the door. In training sessions, the door had opened silently. Now, though, it creaked. The fighters tensed. But there was no reaction from within the sleepy house. One of the team signaled to the man in the other cars that the coast was clear. The rest of the fighters took up positions around the house. One detail circled into the backyard. The Seret Matkal men burst through the door and down the front hall. A few rushed to the basement, where the second bodyguard had just awakened. They shot him before he had time to cock his rifle. Then they saw another sleeping man, the family's Tunisian gardener, who had decided to spend the night. They shot him, too. "He really hadn't done anything," Lev said, "but on a mission like this there's no choice. You have to make sure that any potential opposition is neutralized." Upstairs, Abu Jihad's wife, Intisar, woke up to the sound of men shouting below. Abu Jihad was sitting by his desk. He pushed it back, got up quickly, and took his pistol from the closet. "What happened?" Intisar asked him. "What happened?" A Seret Matkal man, clad in black, his face masked, bounded to the top of the stairs. Lev, the commander, followed close behind. Abu Jihad pushed his wife farther into their bedroom. The first Israeli shot him. Abu Jihad fell. Then Lev fired a long burst. Abu Jihad was dead. Intisar crawled to her husband, wrapped her arms around him. A commando put a pistol in her back, shoved her hard to the wall. She was sure she'd been shot. Instead, she'd been moved out of the way so she wouldn't be. A third commando came in and shot Abu Jihad again. He stood aside, and a fourth Israeli shot him once more. Nidal, the baby boy, was awake and screaming. Intisar was sure he'd been hit, too. A voice downstairs was yelling, "Ale, ale!" Faster, faster. Finally, Lieutenant Colonel Ya'alon stood over the body and fired. The fifth man to do so.
"Bas!"
Intisar cried. "Enough!" Abu Jihad had been shot 52 times. 23 years after Golda Meir signed the first red sheet on his life, he was dead. Recalling the assassination many years later, in 2013, Ya'alon, at that time Minister of Defense, said, "Listen, it certainly wasn't a pleasant scene. The woman was standing there, wanting to rush forward, and only because one of the men was pointing a gun at her, she didn't move, and we are firing into her husband over and over. It is impossible to say that it didn't bother me or make me feel very uncomfortable. On the other hand, it was clear to me that it had to be done, although it was in front of the wife and the daughter." Ya'alon had no regrets, however. He called the operation the perfect hit and added, with characteristic cynicism, "I don't understand why they say we, Israel, are losing the war for mines. If I put a bullet between Abu Jihad's eyes, right in the middle of his mind, doesn't that mean I've won?" All of the Israelis escaped Tunisia unharmed. The local police were busy responding to multiple bogus reports made by the Caesarea operatives of a fleet of cars racing from Abu Jihad's neighborhood toward downtown Tunis, exactly the opposite direction from the one taken by the assassins. The police set up roadblocks and searched dozens of cars. 3 hours later, they found the rented Volkswagens and Peugeot abandoned on the beach. The next afternoon, Shamir was asked by a reporter about Israel's involvement in the targeted killing. "I heard about it," he said dryly, "on the radio." Abu Jihad was buried a few days later with military honors. He had been made a martyr. Yasser Arafat walked behind the coffin with the widow Intisar and her eldest son, Jihad. At the time, the Israelis considered the killing of Abu Jihad to be a tremendous success. "Rabin thanked me later for persuading him," Moshe Nissim said. "You cannot guess how right you were," he told me. "People are cheering me, shaking my hand, giving me the thumbs up. What joy it has brought to the nation. What a feeling of high morale. How right it was for our deterrent force." Indeed, Abu Jihad's death was a severe blow to the PLO. Abu Jihad was a seasoned and shrewd commander, and without him, Fatah was able to launch far fewer successful attacks against Israel. But the immediate professed reason for killing him was to dampen the Intifada. And by that measure, the assassination failed to achieve its goal. In fact, the targeted killing had precisely the opposite effect. The elimination of Abu Jihad greatly weakened the PLO leadership, but bolstered the popular committees in the occupied territories, which were the true leaders of the uprising. And Israel still had no reply to the waves of protesters or the growing tide of international condemnation. With the benefit of hindsight, many Israelis who took part in the operation now regret it. Some believe that Abu Jihad's powerful presence had a restraining and sobering effect on Arafat, and that his voice would have been highly beneficial after the establishment of the Palestinian National Authority in 1994. If the adored and charismatic Abu Jihad had been alive, Hamas might not have been able to consolidate its position and to dominate large parts of the Palestinian public. Amnon Lipkin-Shahak, who was head of Amman at the time of the assassination and later chief of the general staff, said that in an ideal world, if we had known that a short time after Abu Jihad's elimination, the PLO would take the diplomatic course, then perhaps we would have raided his house and first of all talked with him about his attitudes toward a compromise with Israel and only then decided whether to kill him or not. In retrospect, his absence is indeed evident to a certain extent. He could have made a significant contribution to the peace process. Chapter 19. Intifada. On June 23, 1988, an ABC News crew came to the Palestinian village of Salfit, on the slopes of the Sumerian hills in the West Bank. At that point, the occupied territories were still in the turbulent throes of the Intifada. Violent protests, terrorist attacks, rocks, and Molotov cocktails were all daily occurrences. There were many dead on both sides. The international media was attracted by the action. In the small village of Safit resided the Dakduk family. One of their sons, Nizar, figured prominently on the Shin Bet's wanted list, though he was only 18 years old. Intelligence information indicated that he was the leader of a gang of teenagers who hurled gasoline bombs at Israeli buses. Responding to the provocation with a form of collective punishment often used at the time, the IDF had demolished the Dakduk family home on June 16. The next day, Israeli TV broadcast an interview with Nizar and his mother, standing next to the ruins of their home. With a smile, Nizar denied all the accusations against him, but he didn't object strongly when the interviewer suggested that he was considered a local hero. It was evident that he was not averse to media attention. When a separate crew from ABC News arrived a week later and asked the family if it could interview Nizar, he appeared within minutes. The reporter explained that he had been impressed by the Israel TV interview with him and that he wanted to produce a major story about him. The crew suggested that the interview with Nizar take place on a hilltop overlooking the village. Nizar agreed but asked them to wait for a few minutes so he could change his shirt. "No need," said the interviewer, friendly as could be. "I've got a stock of clean shirts in the van. What size do you wear?" Pleased as any young man would be with the attention, Nizar jumped into one of the crew's two vans, both carrying press signs and the ABC logo. The party headed up the hill for the interview. When Nizar failed to return home after a few hours, the family began to worry. The next morning, they called the ABC Bureau in Tel Aviv. The people at the news bureau were surprised to hear that Nizar had disappeared. In fact, they were surprised to hear that anyone from the network had been in Salfit at all. A brief investigation revealed that it was not, in fact, anyone from ABC who had taken Nizar away. ABC suspected Israeli intelligence. Rune Arledge, president of ABC's news division, contacted Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. The friendship between the two gave him access, but Arledge was furious. "The action of the Shin Bet," he said, "presents grave peril to the safety of legitimate journalists." He demanded that an investigation be conducted immediately to ascertain who authorized such an action, and to affirm that it is not the policy of the Israeli government to pose as journalists for whatever reason. Shamir was not aware of the Salfit incident, but he realized that this was a matter that could very quickly become a scandal of major proportions, and he summoned a meeting for that evening with the heads of the military and the intelligence community. The Intifada was characterized by two types of Palestinian activity against the Israeli occupation: huge popular protests and acts of terror against Israeli soldiers and settlers. Back in 1986, Major General Ehud Barak, then the head of the IDF Central Command, together with the head of the Operations Department of the General Staff, Major General Meir Dagan, set up a highly secretive unit, Duvdevan, Hebrew for cherry, to combat terrorists in the West Bank. The unit was now put into action. Its fighters were Mistaravim, who would work undercover, generally posing as Arabs, deep inside Palestinian territory, and hit the people on the wanted list. The nucleus of Duvdevan comprised graduates of elite IDF units, particularly the naval commandos. The Cherry troops exhibited exceptional operational capabilities, thanks to the long and grueling training they underwent, which included special instruction to become familiar with the Arab territories, dress, and disguise techniques. They were uniquely capable of blending in when they were in crowded and hostile Palestinian environments, even in small villages, where strangers attracted immediate attention. It was Cherry that had posed as an ABC crew and abducted Nizar Dakduk in Salfit. Prior to that operation, the men chosen for the mission, one of them born and raised in Canada, and another from the United States, had undergone a few days of intensive training at Israel's state-run television studios in Jerusalem. They learned how a television crew works, how an interview is conducted, how the camera is used, and how the sound man holds the boom mic. Israel's television stations also loaned them the equipment. The Shin Bet was responsible for forging the ABC signs and logos and press credentials. After the fake TV crew picked up Dakduk and left Safit, ostensibly headed toward the hilltop interview site, their van was stopped by what looked like a routine IDF roadblock but was in fact another cherry detail. These men then handcuffed the wanted youth, blindfolded him, and handed him to the Shin Bet for interrogation. Shamir was furious that he had not been asked to approve the Safit operation, and he immediately forbade the use of fake media cover from that point forward, and definitely, definitely not American media. Major Uri Bar-Lev, the officer in charge, who in 1986 was the one who had set Cherry up, tried to calm Shamir down and explain why it had been important to use the ABC News ruse. "Mr. Prime Minister," said Bar-Lev, "we understood that he was just looking for a chance to talk. We knew this was the easiest way to get him out of the village without causing a commotion." Bar-Lev says he brought the videotape shot by the crew to prove how efficient the job had been. And gradually you could see Shamir's crumpled turtle face becoming softer, and even that he was beginning to like it. Shamir smiled. "In the underground, we also have to use disguises sometimes," he said. But he soon snapped out of the nostalgia and repeated his order. "What's done is done, but from now on, no more use of media cover." "Prime Minister, we are in the middle of another operation with the same cover," Bar-Lev said. "I am asking you not to categorically forbid the use of this modus operandi." After a moment's reflection, Shamir said, "Well, okay, but I forbid the use of the cover of American journalists." Dakduk was interrogated and eventually given a long jail term, but in the end he came out alive. In many other cases, however, the IDF refuses to this day, more than 30 years afterward, to release precise figures. The targets of Cherry operations ended up dead. The essence of Cherry was to carry out low-signature killings of terror operatives, said Yoni Koren, an officer in Amman and a close associate of Barak's. "The orders of engagement are very straightforward," observed Bar-Lev. "If the wanted person is seen with a weapon in his hands, i.e., is a danger to our troops, he is to be shot right away." Conversations with former members of the unit revealed that in a large number of its operations, it was clear that the suspect would be armed, and that they were therefore de facto targeted killing missions. Often it was even obligatory to perform dead checking, pumping more bullets into the man after he was down. All this without giving him the chance to surrender. The IDF denied that Cherry performed the dead checking procedure, but proof came after a soldier in the unit, Sergeant Eliyahu Azisha, was killed by friendly fire when he was mistaken for a wanted Palestinian. An IDF Criminal Investigation Division probe revealed that he had been shot multiple times to make sure he was dead. Cherry and other units like it carried out hundreds of missions during the Intifada. Peddlers, shepherds, taxi drivers, female pedestrians on the street. Just about any type of person one might have encountered in an Arab city or village at that time could have turned out to be a Cherry soldier and suddenly drawn a concealed weapon. A terrorist trying to survive doesn't execute attacks. Our activity put the members of the terror cells into absolute uncertainty, said Bar-Lev. They didn't know where it was coming from, didn't know who could be trusted, or where they could feel safe. Sometimes Cherry soldiers even posed as Israeli Jews. In February 1990, the Shin Bet learned that an armed squad with ties to Fatah intended to attack IDF reservists in Manara Square, in the center of the West Bank city of Ramallah. Cherry men dressed like reservists, in sloppy uniforms, pot bellies peeking out of their shirts, and their rifles out of reach as they sat eating hummus in a restaurant on the square. After 2 weeks of waiting, the anticipated attack took place. The reservists sprang into action. They ripped off their latex potbellies and drew out the micro-Uzi machine pistols secreted inside them. They opened fire and killed some of the assailants. Snipers posted nearby took care of the rest. Cherry and similar units set up by the police and the Shin Bet achieved their goal. Severe damage, sometimes fatal, to Palestinian terrorist groups, thus reducing their level of activity to a significant extent. But this success, as important as it may have been, only highlighted the larger strategic failures in the war against the popular uprising. Against the mass protests, Israel had responded with all the grace of a clumsy giant trying to repel a swarm of nimble dwarves. Soldiers rounded up thousands of protesters, and they were sent to special detention camps set up in the south of the country. Large parts of the population of the Palestinian areas were placed under lengthy curfews. The family homes of activists were demolished or boarded up, and they themselves were deported. Many schools remained shut for most of the year. Television footage of the violence led to greater decline in Israel's international standing, and an increase in pressure, now from President George H.W. Bush and Secretary of State James Baker, to sit down and negotiate with the Palestinians. But despite the mounting international criticism, domestic discontent, and the need to send more and more troops to quell the protests, Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir and his Likud-led government refused to hold talks with the PLO over the occupied territories. Shamir and his right-wing ministers continued to view the organization as the force behind the Intifada, and continued to believe the Intifada could be quelled by targeting the mob leaders in the occupied territories, as well as Arafat's men in Tunis. The fact that the assassination of Abu Jihad had done nothing to quiet down the popular uprising did not sway them from this view. The Prime Minister ordered the Mossad to remain focused on gathering intelligence on the PLO and figuring out how to kill its operatives. Mossad Director Shabtai Shavit, whose politics were very similar to Shamir's, happily complied. In fact, he wanted to go even further. With the Intifada whirling, Shavit requested permission to settle old scores and eliminate former members of Black September. The PLO, however, had dramatically tightened its internal security. The Israeli Air Force's strike on Tunis in 1985 and the subsequent commando raid on Abu Jihad led to the establishment of a number of Fatah inquiry panels to locate the leak that provided intelligence to the Israelis. Those investigations came up empty, but nevertheless, stringent precautions were instituted at PLO facilities, background checks for candidates trying to join the organization, strict compartmentalization, polygraph tests administered by Tunisian intelligence, making it very difficult for the Mossad to spy on them. There was no way for the Mossad to recruit agents in Tunis. The local authorities were enraged by the Israeli actions in their territory, and they provided open assistance to the PLO, helping it to tighten its security. So instead, as it had done in many of its recruitment operations, the Mossad looked for likely agents among Palestinians traveling in so-called base countries, those states in which operatives and case officers could function in relative freedom, and where Israel had diplomatic representation. The most convenient country for these activities was France, through which most PLO officials passed after leaving Tunis. Many of them stayed at Le Méridien Montparnasse in Paris, an established, respectable hotel popular among Middle Eastern business travelers. To the surprise of the Mossad personnel, as soon as they began investigating the hotel, they discovered that El Al, the Israeli national airline, enjoyed a corporate discount at the same hotel, and pilots and cabin crews spent their layovers there. Each morning, Mossad surveillance crews watched as senior members of the PLO munched croissant and sipped café au lait in the same cafeteria as El Al pilots, many of whom were officers in the Israeli Air Force reserves, all purely by coincidence. Among the PLO men who frequented the hotel was Adnan Yassin, a mid-level activist who was responsible for logistics and security at the Tunis headquarters. Yassin also assisted his bosses with their personal comforts, coordinating their vacations, arranging their medical care, and procuring luxury goods. Sports cars shipped in containers from Marseille, expensive perfumes, Cuban cigars, and alcoholic drinks. Life in exile, far from the hardships of their people in the occupied territories, had made some of the PLO officials exceedingly corrupt. Yassin took care of his own comforts, too. During the late 80s, many of the senior officials in the organization dipped their hands into the coffers, enjoying the good life at the expense of the Palestinian Revolution. In the Mossad, these men were referred to mockingly as Midawar, Arabic for loafers, or as the Champs-Élysées revolutionaries. Besides his PLO duties, Yassin also frequented Paris because his cancer-stricken wife received chemotherapy there. The couple always stayed at Le Méridien Montparnasse. Yassin had a reliable address, basic routine, and a wealth of PLO intelligence. In late 1989, Avi Dagan, the head of the Mossad's Junction Division, greenlit Operation Golden Fleece to recruit Adnan Yassin. One morning in March 1990, Adnan Yassin sat down to breakfast with some of his PLO colleagues at the hotel. At a nearby table, a well-dressed man of Middle Eastern appearance, his room key on the table, read a newspaper printed on pale green pages. These items, the key, the paper, were not there by chance. Rather, they were props of a junction recruiter trying to establish initial contact with a potential agent. This is a delicate stage, requiring discipline and patience. Most important at this moment, a junction case officer who was involved in Operation Golden Fleece explained, is to try to cause the other side to make the first move and initiate contact. Or at least, not to look as if you are trying too hard. Not to act with suspicion-arousing aggression. For example, you might well be suspicious of a person who comes to the bus stop after you, but much less so of someone who was already there when you came. If I enter an elevator, and someone hurries in after me and then gets off at the same floor as I do, that looks suspicious. If he was there already, much less so. We are talking about innumerable delicate nuances, the aim of which is to allow a situation to flow naturally along. Only rarely will you meet someone sufficiently corrupt for you to wrap things up by handing him a suitcase full of cash. For everyone else, you need real craft, great patience. The room key on the table was there to create a feeling of familiarity, to indicate that the man sitting there was also a guest at Le Méridien. The newspaper with the green pages was well known to any Arabic reader who traveled abroad. Al-Sharq al-Awsat, published in London by a member of the Saudi royal family, and considered relatively moderate. The Mossad was lucky that morning in Paris. One of the people in the PLO breakfast group, though not Yassin himself, asked the Mossad man about something in the paper. The Mossad recruiter congenially handed the man the paper. The conversation then developed between the Palestinians and the Mossad man, who was at pains not to pay any particular attention to Yassin. One member of the group invited the Mossad man to join them, but he refused politely and left the room, so as not to arouse suspicion by appearing too eager. The next morning, the Palestinian group again ran into the Mossad operative, who introduced himself as an Egyptian businessman by the name of Hilmi, and they struck up a lively conversation. 2 days later, Yassin came to the dining room on his own and looked around for some company. He spoke only Arabic, and he was pleased to see Hilmi reading his green newspaper again. He asked if he could join him. Hilmi was happy to say yes. It was the perfect contact method. Yassin was convinced that he had initiated the relationship, and there was no reason for him to be suspicious. Hilmi said that he was in the import-export business between France and the Arab world, hinting that he made quite a bit of money from it. The rapacious Yassin asked to meet later for lunch at a nearby restaurant, and Hilmi agreed. Later, they met twice more. From Hilmi's conversations and information already in the Mossad's possession, Junction developed an understanding of Yassin's character. It was not especially flattering. In his Junction dossier, Yassin is depicted as vulgar, uneducated, aggressive, and coarse. his chief concern being his social status and lining his own pockets. Hilmi reported that Yassin tried to get him involved in petty illegal currency deals and in smuggling contraband into Tunis. Later on, Mossad men witnessed his degrading behavior toward his wife, including one time when he slapped her in public. In short, he was an ideal Mossad recruit. Hilmi and Yassin's friendship progressed. Eventually, Hilmi told Yassin about a friend, a businessman, who was connected to the Iranian embassy in Paris. Hilmi had made a lot of money, he said, because of that friendship. But he never offered to introduce Yassin. He just dangled his connection like bait, waiting patiently for Yassin to take it. And when Yassin finally asked if he could accompany Hilmi the next time he met his contact, Hilmi demurred, like a fisherman playing out a line, not ready to set the hook. Yassin badgered, and Hilmi refused. Finally, after a month of repeated entreaties, Hilmi agreed to introduce him to his Iranian contact. The businessman with the Iranian connections was, of course, just another junction operative. Playing his part perfectly, he described to Yassin a number of future business initiatives he had planned and told him that he could have a stake in some of them. In the meantime, he said, the Islamic Republic of Iran was very concerned about the plight of the Palestinians. It was important for the Iranians to know that the PLO was functioning well and doing the correct things, by which he meant keeping up terror activities against Israel outside its borders and stepping up the Intifada in the West Bank and Gaza. The Islamic Republic, he said, will do all it can to destroy the Zionist entity and to return to the Palestinians what is theirs. Any information Yassin could provide from PLO headquarters would be welcome, and handsomely rewarded. Junction was betting that it would be easier for Yassin to betray the PLO if he believed he was selling its secrets to Iran rather than the enemy. The bet paid off. Yassin turned out to be an exceptional investment for the Mossad. In exchange for a few tens of thousands of dollars, he supplied an enormous amount of high-quality intelligence during regular debriefings in Paris. Primarily, he provided information about Haman Chot, the PLO headquarters in Tunis, giving details about the day-to-day activities there and about the plans hatched there. Yassin outlined everything, including shifting organizational structures, who sat in which office, who met with whom, how Abu Jihad's powers had been dispersed and reassigned, weapons transfers, how the Intifada was stoked, preparations for terror attacks, and personnel recruitment. He interspersed his detailed operational reports with quality gossip. He was the first to tell of the close relationship developing between Suha, the daughter of the Palestinian national poet Raymond Attawil, and Chairman Arafat, who had made Suha an advisor in his bureau. The two were married a short time later. Adnan Yassin also brought a plan by Arafat and one of his operatives, Jibril Rajoub, to the attention of Israeli intelligence. The plan was to kill Yitzhak Shamir and Ariel Sharon as revenge for the assassination of Abu Jihad. The designated assassin, a frustrated and debt-burdened Israeli Jew by the name of Rafael Avraham, landed in Israel in October 1992, carrying a large amount of cash and the assassination plan with him. Adnan Yassin knew about the plan because he had booked Avraham's travel arrangements. Byrd's operatives were waiting for Avraham when he got off the plane. Rajoub was stunned. I really did not understand how the Shin Bet got onto him so quickly. He didn't manage to do anything. Just got off the plane and hop, he was captured. Yassin was an endless fountain of information, an asset of almost unimaginable value. Through him, the Mossad was able to instantly track many of its top assassination targets, primarily because, once again, he was the man who made all their flight and hotel reservations. One such instance occurred in late January 1992, after the French authorities, via the Red Cross in France, permitted George Habash, the head of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, to visit the country for medical treatment, despite the fact that he was on their most wanted list and those of several other countries. Acting on Yassin's intelligence, The Israelis examined the possibility of eliminating him, but the French were taking precautions to protect him. Instead of the hit, then, the Mossad leaked the scandalous news of his visit to the media, causing considerable embarrassment for the government of François Mitterrand. Yassin also kept tabs on men the Mossad believed had been involved in the 1972 Munich massacre. Despite the fact that the red pages for these men had been signed by Golda Meir almost 20 years earlier, some of them remained at large. From our point of view, the red pages were open-ended, an aide to Mossad director Shavit said. One of the names high up on that list was Atef Bisseso, who had been a member of Black September at the time of the terror attack and, by 1992, had become a top PLO official. It was never clear exactly what role he played in the Munich attack. The PLO claimed he was not involved at all, but the Mossad insisted he was, and, in any case, it made no difference. Shavit was determined to avenge Munich, and anyone connected to Black September was, in his mind, a legitimate target. Still, it was an odd distraction. At this point, the entirety of the Middle East was consumed by the Intifada. The occupied territories were in flaming turmoil. Israel had far more pressing intelligence needs than killing people for atrocities they may or may not have been involved in 2 decades earlier. Nonetheless, Shamir re-endorsed the red page for Bisseso. The reason, a Kasareya operative said, was simply because we had access. That access was Yassin. In early June 1992, Bisseso left Tunis for a series of meetings with the German and French intelligence services, as well as with the CIA's Robert Baer. In 1979, the Mossad assassinated Ali Salameh, who was the liaison with the CIA, Baer said. We were certain they did it to cut off the link with us. Hani al-Hassan and then Atef Bisseso replaced him. I arrived in Paris on that day to hold the periodic meeting with him. According to a number of sources, these meetings were another primary reason the Mossad wanted to kill Bisseso. The Mossad realized he was one of the main links between the PLO and intelligence agencies in the West, including those of Germany, France, and America. And top Israeli intelligence officials believed that these ties were one more step toward the West's bestowment of full international diplomatic legitimization upon Arafat and the PLO, and the isolation of Israel. The fact that the Palestinian liaisons were former members of Black September only stoked the Israelis' rage further. Their protests to the Western states fell on deaf ears, so Israel decided to convey its displeasure in a more direct manner. Because he had once again made the travel arrangements, Yassin knew that at the last minute Bisseso had decided to drive from Bonn to Paris rather than fly, and that he had changed his hotel from Le Méridien Étoile to Le Méridien Montparnasse. Ironically, Bisseso made these changes because he was concerned about his safety. A bayonet team was waiting for Bisseso in the hotel lobby. They tailed him up to his room and waited while he unpacked, showered, and dressed for the evening. They kept close to him as he went out for dinner with friends at the nearby hippopotamus restaurant, and then returned to the hotel. As he left the car at the entrance of the hotel and headed for the lobby, 2 bayonet men shot him 5 times. The pistol they used was equipped with a silencer, and immediately after the killing, they collected their empty cartridges in a bag, in order to make things more difficult for investigators. A man purporting to be a spokesman for the Abu Nidal organization claimed responsibility for the slaying, but this claim was immediately denied by one of the organization's real spokesmen. Arafat was quick to accuse Israel. Amman's chief at that time, Major General Yuri Sagi, declared soon afterward that he did not know who had carried out the killing, but he added that Bisseso had been involved in the Munich massacre, the abortive attack on an LL plane in Rome in 1978, and the attempted murder of the Jordanian ambassador in London. The backlash to the targeted killing of Bisseso was swift. The CIA was infuriated that the Mossad had again interfered with its ties to the PLO. The French were even more angry. To them, the hit, in front of an elegant Paris hotel, was a grave violation of national sovereignty. French agents began to rein in